Welcome back to our study of the Law of Moses. Last week, we began looking at the Goel, this kinsman redeemer in the Law of Moses. The Goel is the guy who's supposed to have your back in times of trouble. And so last week, we looked at the Goel's redemptive roles, bailing out people in financial trouble, providing heirs for deceased relatives. The Goel has one other role. His final, most grisly job is to avenge bloodshed. Now, some of our English translations obscure this connection by translating Goel as avenger instead of redeemer. And it makes for good English, right? Because in English, avenger and redeemer don't really have the same sense. So I'm not complaining about the translation. It's just something we need to understand. It's the same term in Hebrew. It's the same, mainly, first off, it's the same person, right? The same sorts of people who could fit the redemptive role of the Goel would also fit the avenging role of the Goel, right? So going back to the Book of Ruth, if someone had murdered Elimelech, Boaz would be a suitable person to avenge Elimelech's blood, right? As it was, Elimelech just died and, you know, there weren't any heirs left behind for Ruth. And, you know, Ruth and Naomi are widowed. They're having to sell off land. And so we get to see Boaz's redemptive role as the Goel. But the Goel is also there to avenge bloodshed. In the text that we're going to look at today, he is referred to as the Goel of blood. Again, commonly translated as the Avenger of blood. We find the instructions for the Goel of blood in a couple of places. We're going to look in just a second at Numbers chapter 35, verses 9 through 34. We also find these instructions in Deuteronomy chapter 19, verses 1 through 13. We're going to focus on Numbers because it gives us a little additional information, but definitely read both. All right, turn to Deuteronomy 19 at some point. In fact, you might even want to pause the recording after we finish reading Numbers 35 and go and read Deuteronomy 19. You'll notice some subtle differences in the way that the law draws this distinction between manslaughter and murder. We talked about it a bit a few weeks ago, but it's good to refresh your mind on that. But we're going to read now from Numbers chapter 35, beginning in verse 9. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel, and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall select cities to be cities of refuge for you, that the manslayer who kills any person without intent may flee there. The cities shall be for you a refuge from the avenger, that is the Goel, that the manslayer may not die until he stands before the congregation for judgment. And the cities that you shall give... the cities you give shall be your six cities of refuge. You shall give three cities beyond the Jordan, and three cities in the land of Canaan, to be cities of refuge. These six cities shall be for refuge for the people of Israel, and for the stranger, and for the sojourner among them, that anyone who kills any person without intent may flee there. But if he struck him down with an iron object so that he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. And if he struck him down with a stone tool that could cause death, and he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. Or if he struck him down with a wooden tool that could cause death, and he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. The avenger of blood shall himself put the murderer to death. When he meets him, he shall put him to death. And if he pushed him out of hatred or hurled something at him, lying in wait so that he died, or in enmity struck him down with his hand so that he died, then he who struck the blow shall be put to death. He is a murderer. The avenger of blood shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. But if he pushed him suddenly without enmity, or hurled anything on him without lying in wait, or used a stone that could cause death and without seeing him dropped it on him so that he died, though he was not his enemy and did not seek his harm, then the congregation shall judge between the manslayer and the avenger of blood in accordance with these rules. and the congregation shall rescue the manslayer from the hand of the avenger of blood. And the congregation shall restore him to his city of refuge to which he had fled, and he shall live in it until the death of the high priest who was anointed with the holy oil. But if the manslayer shall at any time go beyond the boundaries of his city of refuge to which he had fled, and the avenger of blood finds him outside the boundaries of his city of refuge, and the avenger of blood kills the manslayer, he shall not be guilty of blood. For he must remain in his city of refuge until the death of the high priest. But after the death of the high priest, the manslayer may return to the land of his possession. And these things shall be for a statute and rule for you throughout your generations in all your dwelling places. If anyone kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death on the evidence of witnesses. But no person shall be put to death on the testimony of one witness. Moreover, you shall accept no ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall be put to death. And you shall accept no ransom for him who has fled to his city of refuge, that he may return to dwell in the land before the death of the high priest. You shall not pollute the land in which you live, for blood pollutes the land. And no atonement can be made for the land, for the blood that is shed in it, except by the blood of the one who shed it. You shall not defile the land in which you live, in the midst of which I dwell. For I, the Lord, dwell in the midst of the people of Israel. Right, so a lot of stuff to take in there. But we should remember this from our study on violence a few weeks ago. We should remember, first off, that the law distinguishes between murder and manslaughter. Manslaughter is a forgivable offense, but the manslayer has to stay in one of the cities of refuge until the death of the high priest, like we just read. I want us to focus our attention on the role of the Goel in all of this. All right, so every place in which we read avenger of blood in our text, that is the Goel of blood. The Goel's job that we've just read in Numbers 35 is to redeem the shed blood of his kinsmen. So as with the other duties of the Redeemer, the Goel is acting on behalf of the family. He's acting in the interests of the family. So it is not only the Goel's duty to raise up an heir for his deceased kinsman, it's also his duty to bring his kinsman's murderer to justice. And in doing this, the Goel is fulfilling the requirement of the law that is set out at the time of Noah. All right, so this is one of the oldest laws that we have, this requirement that blood is required for blood. All right, we read that requirement in Numbers 35, but I want us to see just how far back this goes. Now turn to Genesis chapter 9. We'll read verses 5 and 6. God speaking to Noah says, "And for your lifeblood I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image." All right, so this is something that goes way, way back. This is a primordial law. It's given before Moses, and it ties back to creation principles. Man was made in God's image, and so if you shed man's blood, your blood is to be shed. And so the Goel is not just acting on behalf of the family, he is also restoring this duty. He's restoring this balance, as it were. He's fulfilling this requirement, this ancient requirement, that blood is required for blood. And this kind of language, by the way, makes sense of calling this kinsman the redeemer of blood. Right? This is the sense in which this role of the Goel is consistent with the other roles of the Goel. He is redeeming the blood of his kinsmen with the blood of the murderer. And by redeeming the blood of his murdered kinsmen, the Goel is also cleansing the land of blood guilt, like we read in Numbers 35. Blood pollutes the land. And so you can't leave that there. Right? It's not just going to be a stain on the murderer, it's also going to have an effect on all Israel. So the Goel is not just serving the interests of the family, he is serving the interests of all Israel when he chases down the murderer and puts him to death. Now, but the law recognizes that the Goel's wrath can actually create more blood guilt. because it recognizes this distinction between murder and manslaughter, it recognizes that the Goel the Goel is the last party who should determine that distinction for himself, right? He's an interested party. He is furthermore wrathful, and so he's not the one to judge. Ultimately, it is the congregation of Israel that is to judge, and that is why the cities of refuge are established. They create an opportunity for the people of Israel to render judgment. The killer, whether he is a murderer or a manslayer, can run to one of these cities. He can run to, that's why they're called sanctuary cities. He is protected by the congregation of Israel until the congregation can render judgment in his case. And they keep the Goel from shedding blood without justification. Because if the Goel, say the Goel is chasing someone down who is guilty only of manslaughter instead of murder, and the Goel catches the manslayer and kills him, then that's more blood guilt on the land. So in just a moment, we'll look at an example of the Goel of blood, how these principles are acted out in Israel's history. But first, we need to fill in some information that we're missing. We've been missing this information since we first picked up Numbers 35 a few weeks ago in our study on violence. We have read this law, again, a few times now, but we have yet to name the cities of refuge, because at this point in the law, Israel is in the wilderness. They've not entered the promised land, and so they're merely commanded, once you enter the promised land, you need to set apart these six cities. And so it's not until Israel does enter the promised land that we see which six cities are set apart. We get some names to apply to this law. So to see that, we need to turn to Joshua chapter 20. Joshua chapter 20, the entire chapter is dedicated to setting aside the cities of refuge. So let's turn and read there, beginning in verse 1. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Say to the people of Israel, appoint the cities of refuge of which I spoke to you through Moses, that the manslayer who strikes any person without intent or unknowingly may flee there. They shall be for you a refuge from the avenger of blood. He shall flee to one of these cities and shall stand at the entrance of the gate of the city and explain his case to the elders of that city. Then they shall take him into the city and give him a place, and he shall remain with them. And if the avenger of blood pursues him, they shall not give up the manslayer into his hand because he struck his neighbor unknowingly and did not hate him in the past. And he shall remain in that city until he is stood before the congregation for judgment, until the death of him who is high priest at the time. Then the manslayer may return to his own town and his own home, to the town from which he fled." So they set apart Kadesh in Galilee, in the hill country of Naphtali, and Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim, and Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the hill country of Judah. And beyond the Jordan, east of Jericho, they appointed Bezer in the wilderness on the tableland, from the tribe of Reuben, and Ramot in Gilead, from the tribe of Gad, and Golan in Bashan, from the tribe of Manasseh. These were the cities designated for all the people of Israel and for the stranger sojourning among them, that anyone who killed a person without intent could flee there, so that he might not die by the hand of the avenger of blood, till he stood before the congregation. All right, so these are the cities that are set apart as the cities of refuge. Just like the law commands, you have three in Canaan, and you have three on the other side of the river, east of the Jordan. It's useful, by the way, to memorize this list of six cities, because they come up pretty frequently in Israel's history. And as you're reading Israel's history, it's good to be able to say to yourself, right, this is happening in one of the sanctuary cities. All right, so you've got Kadesh in Galilee. You've got Shechem. Shechem ought to be really easy to remember. Major, major city. So Kadesh, Shechem, and Kiriath Arba, which is not commonly referred to as Kiriath Arba. It's more commonly referred to as Hebron, which the text tells us. All right, so Kadesh, Shechem, Hebron, those are the cities in Canaan. And notice you've got they are they're dispersed throughout the land of Canaan, right? Because you've got Naphtali up in the far north, so the city of Kadesh is available if you're up in the far north of Israel. Shechem is kind of mid-Israel, you know, in the tribe of Ephraim. And then you've got Hebron in the south of Israel among the tribe of Judah. So they're spread out so that wherever you're at in Israel, you've got some sanctuary city relatively close by that you can flee to. On the other side of the river, you have three cities, Bezer, Ramoth, and Golan. We don't hear about these quite as often as the ones in Canaan, but you do still hear about them every once in a while. So, those are the cities. And we've essentially seen the whole law as it pertains to the Goel of Blood. We've seen what the law requires in Numbers 35. We've seen the distinctions that are made there. We've seen the process that is supposed to take place. We have seen the names of the cities that are appointed to be sanctuary cities. We're going to close our time together today by playing a game. We're going to take what we have learned in our short time together today and apply it to a case study. So we're going to read a story. We're going to read the story of Abner, what he did to David's nephew Asahel, and what Joab, Asahel's brother and David's general, did to Abner in return. And we're going to see if we can determine who's in the right and who's in the wrong based off of what we know from the law. Our story starts in 2 Samuel chapter 2, and let's establish some context for what we're about to read. First off, Saul is dead. That is King Saul. Remember, the Lord has taken Israel from Saul, and he is giving the kingdom to David. Saul has known this for a long time, and Saul continues to be rebellious and tries to murder David, and David's on the run for a long time. Well, finally, things catch up to Saul, and he and his son Jonathan die in this battle against the Philistines at the end of 1 Samuel. So Saul and Jonathan's bodies are rescued. They're taken down from where the Philistines had pinned them up, and they are given a proper burial. Israel is recovering from that, but David is not yet king over all Israel. Even though Saul is out of the way, David is not yet king over the whole nation. He is instead king over the house of Judah. So he's been anointed king already, and he is enthroned, but he really only wields power in the territory of the tribe of Judah. And he reigns in the city of Hebron, in the hill country of Judah. Now, that's what's going on in Judah. Elsewhere, Saul's general, Abner, has anointed Saul's son, Ishbosheth, as king over the rest of Israel. Even though we learn over the first few chapters of 2 Samuel that Ishbosheth is really just a puppet king, and Abner's the one really in charge of the house of Saul. In fact, that's going to lead to a consequential debate, an argument later on. So that's the current situation. You've got Saul dead. Ishbosheth is king over Israel, but he's not really king. Abner's really the one pulling the strings. In Judah, David is king, and Joab is his general. The case that we're going to consider today kicks off with a meeting between David's men and Ishbosheth's men at the pool of Gibeon. So let's turn to 2 Samuel chapter 2, we're going to begin in verse 12. Abner the son of Ner, and the servants of Ishbosheth the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. And Joab the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David, went out and met them at the pool of Gibeon. And they sat down, the one on the one side of the pool, and the other on the other side of the pool. And Abner said to Joab, "Let the young men arise and compete before us." And Joab said, "Let them arise." Then they arose and passed over by number, 12 for Benjamin and Ishbosheth the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. And each caught his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in his opponent's side, so they fell down together. Therefore that place was called Helkat Hazurim, which is at Gibeon. And the battle was very fierce that day, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. And the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. Now Asahel was as swift of foot as a wild gazelle. And Asahel pursued Abner, and as he went, he turned neither to the right hand nor to the left from following Abner. And then Abner looked behind him and said, "Is it you, Asahel?" And he answered, "It is I." And Abner said to him, "Turn aside to your right hand or to your left, and seize one of the young men and take his spoil." But Asahel would not turn aside from following him. And Abner said again to Asahel, "Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face to your brother Joab?" But he refused to turn aside. Therefore Abner struck him in the stomach with the butt of his spear, so that the spear came out at his back. And he fell there and died where he was. And all who came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died stood still. All right, so we read of the killing of Asahel at the hand of Abner. The story starts with an ostensibly peaceful gathering at the pool of Gibeon. You've got these two parties sitting on opposite sides of the pool, and Abner suggests that the young men make sport for the entertainment of the two groups. So what the ESV renders is, you let the young men compete for us. The sort of competition that we're talking about is basically like mock battle. It's play is what it is. It's sport. Let's have a competition. Let's wrestle, as it were. So it's meant to be, at least it's supposed to be, good-natured, harmless competition. But it becomes immediately apparent that the two houses have thinly veiled animosity toward one another. The animosity that is so bad that this sparring, what's supposed to be, again, just friendly sport, results in all two dozen competitors immediately killing each other. All of them simultaneously stabbing each other in the side, so they all fall down dead at the same time. Right? It's the sort of thing that I'm surprised no director has ever taken this on in a film, because this would be the kind of scene that would just make people go wild in film. It would be easy to get real artistic with this. But you can see just how this just immediately devolves into violent armed conflict. All of these guys that, again, are supposed to be, you know, basically wrestling with each other, stab each other, kill each other, and then bedlam. Everybody starts, you know, everybody was kung fu fighting, as it were. Everything devolves into full-scale conflict. And it's not just people beating on each other, it's people killing each other. And it ends up with David's men getting the best of Abner's men, and Abner beating a hasty retreat. This is where you enter Asahel, one of David's nephews. You remember, the sons of Zeruiah are David's nephews. So Joab, Abishai, Asahel, David, King David is their uncle. And Asahel is a good enough runner to keep up with Abner. And so he chases after Abner, and Abner warns him, "Hey, don't follow me, turn aside, right? Stop chasing me, go collect some spoil from one of the other men. I don't want to have to kill you." All right, so the thought has already entered Abner's mind, "I could kill this kid." And Asahel refuses to stop, so the whole encounter ends with Abner pulling up short and ramming the butt of his spear backwards through Asahel's gut so that it comes out through his back. Again, this is the sort of conflict that I'm surprised no film director has taken on yet. And Asahel, I'm sorry, not Asahel, Abner is apparently just a beast of a man. That it takes a guy like Asahel to keep up with him, and that he is strong enough to ram the butt end of his spear, not the pointy end, the butt end of his spear, straight through Asahel's gut and out his back. Abner is a hoss. Now, what we don't read after this, what the end of 2 Samuel chapter 2 covers, is that Joab chases Abner to avenge Asahel. But he eventually lets him go, because Abner makes it to the people of Gibeon, and so he's got this whole group of people with him, and he reasons with Joab, and says, look, let's not... I mean, he essentially tells Joab, let's not let this turn into some Hatfields and McCoys thing. Right? The specific phrase that he uses is, you know, shall the sword devour forever? In other words, if you kill me, you know, somebody from my family is just going to chase you down and kill you, and then your brother Abishai is going to chase down my kinsman and kill him, and it's just going to go back and forth, and it's just going to be constant war between our families. Shall the sword devour forever? Just let it drop, Abner says. And Joab seemingly lets it drop. But this whole, you know, this conflict is bigger than just Abner and Joab. This fight that has broken out at the Pool of Gibeon leads to full-scale war between the houses of David and Saul, which we had come to expect anyway, since David is supposed to be king over all Israel, and Ishbosheth is basically usurping David's proper God-given place. So this war breaks out. We read about this at the beginning of chapter 3, and it's at this time that Abner and Ishbosheth have a falling out. Because Abner's the one running things. And Ishbosheth basically kind of walks in. Ishbosheth discovers what Abner is doing in trying to take over the house, namely laying with one of Saul's concubines. And so Ishbosheth challenges him on it, and Abner lets him have it. And vows to defect to David. Ishbosheth can't do anything about it. Ishbosheth is kind of he's consistently presented as like a little 90-pound weakling in the histories of Israel. There, he is helpless to do anything about Abner. And Abner tells Ishbosheth to his face, I am going to defect to David. And that's what we find him doing later in 2 Samuel chapter 3. Let's pick up in verse 17. And Abner conferred with the elders of Israel, saying, for some time past you have been seeking David as king over you. Now then bring it about, for the Lord has promised David, saying, by the hand of my servant David I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies. Abner also spoke to Benjamin. And then Abner went to tell David at Hebron, all that Israel and the whole house of Benjamin thought good to do. When Abner came with 20 men to David at Hebron, David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. And Abner said to David, I will arise and go and will gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you and that you may reign over all that your heart desires. So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. So this is a great deal for David. Abner is not only himself defecting over to David, but he's promised to take all Israel with him. Because again, it's Abner that's been in charge, not really Ishbosheth. And so he comes to David with this offer. I'm going to hand you national unity, a unified kingdom. You won't have to fight for it. It's just going to be given to you. In fact, he's gone ahead and he's laid the groundwork for it. He goes and he visits the elders of Israel. He goes around in the tribe of Benjamin. And he gets everything lined up. He's got everything ready for Israel to also anoint David as king, so that David will be the king over the entire nation, not just Judah. Now, remember David's place in all of this. David is Asahel's uncle, and Abner has killed Asahel. What exactly we want to make of that, we'll talk about a little bit later. But Abner has killed David's nephew, Asahel. What does David do about it? From what we just read, he does nothing. He throws Abner a feast, because what is David going to get out of this alliance with Abner? He's getting all Israel. That's something that is just too good for him to pass up. So he doesn't raise the issue of Asahel at all with Abner. He throws him a feast, and then sends him away in peace. Now, how is Joab going to take all of this? That's what we learn in the following passage. So we'll pick up where we left off in 2 Samuel chapter 3, verse 22. Just then the servants of David arrived with Joab from a raid, bringing much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David at Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. When Joab and all the army that was with him came, it was told Joab, Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he has let him go, and he has gone in peace. Then Joab went to the king and said, What have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why is it that you have sent him away, so that he's gone? You know that Abner the son of Ner came to deceive you, and to know you're going out and you're coming in, and to know all that you're doing. When Joab came out from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the cistern of Sirah. But David did not know about it. And when Abner returned from Hebron, Joab took him aside into the midst of the gate to speak with him privately. And there he struck him in the stomach so that he died for the blood of Asahel his brother. Afterward, when David heard of it, he said, I and my kingdom are forever guiltless before the Lord for the blood of Abner the son of Ner. May it fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his father's house. And may the house of Joab never be without one who has a discharge, or who is leprous, or who holds a spindle, or who falls by the sword, or who lacks bread. So Joab and Abishai his brother killed Abner, because he had put their brother Asahel to death in the battle at Gibeon. So, we see what Joab thinks of all this. Joab is furious with David that he has let Abner go, and Joab takes it into his own hands to call Abner back into the city, and then he takes him to the city gates, you know, where deals are struck. We saw this at the end of Ruth. That's where you go to sit down with people and strike deals in the presence of the elders. That's where judgment is made. In fact, in Numbers 35, that's where we saw that judgment is to be rendered in the case of the murderer or the manslayer. They're to be judged at the gates by the congregation of Israel. And then, the murderer is to be handed over to the Goel of blood. So Joab takes Abner to the gates of the city and pulls him aside and stabs him in the gut and kills him in the city gate. So, thus is the blood of Asahel avenged on Abner. So here's our question. All right, we've read our story. This is our case study. Here's the question. Was Joab right to put Abner to death the way that he did? There's a lot of things for us to consider here, most of which I'm not going to provide any definite answers on, because I want you to puzzle this through yourself. All right, we need to consider, first off, the death of Asahel in 2 Samuel chapter 2. Was it a murder? All right, go back to Numbers 35. Go back to Deuteronomy 19. Consider the criteria. Go back to 2 Samuel 2 and read how things fall out between Abner and Asahel. Where would you place Asahel's death? Is it murder or is it manslaughter? Is Abner a murderer or a manslayer? So that's question one. Does Asahel's blood need to be avenged on Abner? Question two. Was Joab in a position to rightfully act as Asahel's Goel? Now, I think this one has a clearer answer, because Joab is Asahel's brother, and the Goel is always a near kinsman. But I want you to consider, though, if there's anyone else in the story who could also function as Asahel's Goel. Now, having gotten this far, let us suppose for a second, and this is just part of the thought experiment, we'll say. So I'm not going to say in this video one way or the other how we should judge Asahel's death. But let us suppose that we were to judge Asahel's death to be a murder. And let us suppose that we recognize Joab's standing as Asahel's Goel. So Abner is a murderer. Asahel is the victim. Joab is the redeemer of blood. We've read about all these things in Numbers 35. Is there anything else that we need to consider from Numbers chapter 35 as we consider whether or not, whether it was right or wrong for Joab to kill Abner in the way that he did? Right, ponder over that for a minute. In fact, you might even want to pause the recording. Right, go back, look at the texts, look at what happens in 2 Samuel 3, and ponder that over. Is there anything that we're missing out of Numbers 35 that would either legitimize or delegitimize what Joab has done? All right, so do you have your answer? Let's consider one last thing. Something that we read in 2 Samuel chapter 3. Where does Joab put Abner to death? It's in the city of Hebron. Now, what do we know about the city of Hebron? What did we learn about it in Joshua chapter 20? Hebron is one of the sanctuary cities. If this had happened practically anywhere else, I think it's possible to make a good case for Joab. In fact, remember, Abner had already left the city, and Joab called him back into the city. Remember what Numbers 35 says about the manslayer who leaves the sanctuary city, right? Like, that consideration by itself would just entirely end run that question about whether Asahel's death is manslaughter or murder. It wouldn't matter. If the killer is outside of the sanctuary city, he's fair game, right? Because the sanctuary city law basically is a very, very high stakes game of tag, right? The killer is on the run and had better pray that the Goel of blood doesn't catch up with him. So how would things have shaken out if Joab had just instead chased Abner down outside of Hebron? Well, I'm not going to give the definitive answer to that either. That's something to consider. What we can consider, though, is what did happen. Abner comes back into the city of Hebron. He is in the gates of the sanctuary city. And what is supposed to happen at the gates of the sanctuary city? According to the law, the congregation of Israel is to render judgment first. And then they decide, the congregation decides between the slayer, whether he's a murderer or a manslayer, they judge between him and the avenger of blood. So Abner is supposed to be tried, and then he is either to be held in the city until the death of the high priest, or he's to be delivered over to Joab to be put to death. That entire process gets skipped. What Joab engages in is an extrajudicial killing. So who all is in the wrong here? Well, if we judge the killing of Asahel to be a murder, then obviously Abner's in the wrong. Joab, I think we can definitively say that Joab is in the wrong for engaging in an extrajudicial killing. In fact, based on what we have read in Numbers 35, it seems that Joab is actually guilty of adding more blood guilt to the land, because this process of justice has not taken place properly. But most of all, the one who is in the greatest wrong in all of this might surprise you. It's actually David. Because David is king, and he lives in Hebron. It's the king's job to execute justice, to render judgment. It's the king's job to make sure that that gets done. And furthermore, David is the other party in this story who can suitably, who has standing as one of Asahel's redeemers. Joab is obviously closer, but Abner gets to David first. And so David should have dealt with it, but David refuses to handle the matter appropriately. Again, David's there in the sanctuary city. He could have called a tribunal together to judge Abner's case. David knew what had happened between Abner and Asahel, and there were witnesses to it. David should have rendered judgment, but what does David do? He ignores the whole thing. And why does he do it? Because Abner is bringing all of Israel to David. It's too good of a deal for David to give up. It's too great a price for justice. And so David corrupts justice. And the result is that it ends up in this extrajudicial killing in the gates of the sanctuary city. It's ultimately David's job to ensure that justice is done, and David failed. And this is not the last time that David's going to fail in precisely this way. This is actually the story, by and large, of David's kingship. Remember, at this point, we've seen David as... David is the kid who's on the run from Saul. David, who is king just over Judah, and still working on consolidating the kingdom. We've not really entered into the full kingship of David yet. The rest of David's kingship is going to be characterized by this kind of failure to render proper judgment, and it's going to keep coming up even later in 2 Samuel. This case study shows us something about the law. Even though it is designed to prevent wrongs and to right the wrongs that have happened, even though it's there to prevent unnecessary bloodshed, it often fails. And why does it fail? It ultimately fails because of us. It fails because of human frailty. Think of what all had to fail for this whole thing to shake out the way that it did. Right? It starts with, again, with a wrestling match gone wrong. They couldn't keep it together long enough to just have a peaceful encounter with one another at the Pool of Gibeon. That kicks off this whole thing. And then you've got Abner, who can't... I mean, he apparently can outrun Asahel. I mean, Asahel can keep up with him, but Abner can keep going. Right? Asahel also could have just stopped, but instead decides to go after Abner. Abner decides to kill Asahel. David decides not to deal with it when he has the opportunity. Joab decides to trick Abner into coming back into Hebron and murders him. So, just a chain of failure. And that's the whole history of Israel, right? That's the whole history of humanity. Just one failure after another, a long succession of failures to abide by the law of God. So what's the solution for that? Well, the solution, as we'll see next week, is for God himself to stand in the place of Goel. The law points to God's own role as redeemer and as avenger. And that ultimately, of course, culminates in the work of Jesus Christ, both the redeeming and the avenging aspect of it. These are things, again, that carry forward into the New Testament. So we'll see how the law and the prophets look at God as the ultimate, the ideal Goel, and how that's fulfilled in Jesus' ministry, and how that's going to be fulfilled in another sense in the last day, in the final judgment. So it's a big, I mean, it's a story that stretches almost cover to cover in the Bible, God's role as redeemer and avenger. So I hope this study has been edifying for you. That's going to wrap it up for us this week. Don't forget, if you're watching this on YouTube, don't forget to hit that like button on this video, because that helps get this material in front of other people so that we can be sowing the seeds of the kingdom on YouTube among strangers. The internet is a wonderful tool for spreading the gospel. We get hits from all over the place, and we get basically a better chance of that happening if you take the time to just click the like button on the video, the little thumbs up. Definitely don't click the thumbs down. So again, that will help what we're doing here on YouTube. I hope that everyone is doing well in the current unpleasantness. Things seem to get crazier before they get calmer. All of this, it reminds us to eagerly await the return of our Lord, and we look forward to that. And we look forward to seeing all of you again soon, Lord willing, next week. So, until then, take care. Bye-bye.